much, Paul. Thanks very much. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's fantastic to come to Cork at last. People have been telling me for years Cork's the best city in Ireland. And so far I can see that the vibe is right.
Here we go.
Yeah, we'll be fine, Paul. We'll put them over there and reach out. I'm going to start off with a wee bilingual poem. It's just called Kids' Poem, Bairn Sang. It was January, and a gey-dreich day the first day I went to the school. So my mum happed me up in my good navy blue nap coat with a red tartan hood, birled a scarf around my neck, pulled on my pixie and my pockies, it was that bitter, said, "Now you'll no starve." Gave me a wee kiss and a kid on skelp in the bum and sent me off across the playground to the place I'd learned to say. It was January and a really dismal day the first day I went to school. So my mother wrapped me up in my best navy blue top coat with the red tartan hood, twirled a scarf around my neck, pulled on my bubble hat and mittens, it was so bitterly cold, said, "Now you won't freeze to death." Gave me a little kiss and a pretend slap on the bottom and sent me off across the playground to the place I'd learned to forget to say. It was January and a gey-dreich day, the first day I went to the school. So my mum happed me up in my good navy blue nap coat with a red tartan hood, birled a scarf around my neck, glued on my pixie and my pockies, it was that bitter. Oh, saying it was one thing, but when it came to writing it, in black and white, the way it had to be said, was as if you were posh, grown up, male, English, and dead. It's a huge big honour to be here for the last reading of the day, of the year. So I might as well. Ah. Sensible Rosie O'Regan. Yes, look at that. I've now got. Yes, there we are. Thank you very much. Just last week I had a lovely gig in, no, it was more than that. It was the 4th of December, I had a lovely gig in Trafalgar Square. There's a tree that comes from Norway every year to Trafalgar Square. They call it the Queen of the Forest, and it's very, very tall, and it's been coming every year since 1947. It's in memory of what Britain did for Norway during the war, and you know, the Norwegian government in exile was there all during the war. So I was quite busy and I didn't know if I wanted this gig, because you've got to write a recipe for school kids to write a poem, you've got to get in all these poems from school kids, you've got to make a poem out of their poems and as much of as you want of your own. But I thought, I can't resist this, because that tree's been coming since Christmas 1947, and I was born on St. Stephen's Day 1947, so I thought, I've got to do it, haven't I? Yeah. So, more inner child stuff. You know, there's nothing wrong with finding their inner child, but it's a child's poem, and three kids performed it, and the tree got lit up, so it was a bit good to be in Trafalgar Square, and the poem's all around the tree. And when I came back late that night to look at it, the first day it was up, there was a tramp reading it in the right order and going right round it, laughing a wee bit. So I thought, that's all right. He's still got his inner child. So, you know, it's getting near Christmas, so a Christmas poem. How I'll decorate my tree. It was still very far from Christmas when my mama said to me, "Tell me, precious, what you gonna hang from our Christmas tree?" I said, "The fairy lights that Dad just fixed and jewel-coloured jelly beans from the pick-and-mix. Oh, and from it I'll dangle tinsel and tangles sparkles, sequins and spangles, a round golden coin, chocolate money, that cracker joke that was actually funny, my rosary beads and a plastic rose as red as Rudolph Reindeer's nose, the gnome that grows the tangerines, the picture of me with my tambourine, and Mum's favourite, she says, the photo of all of us in our PJs. That Ladybird book that Lola lent me, the blue butterfly bracelet that Brittany sent me, the earring I lost, a pop-up Jack Frost, a space hopper, an everlasting gobstopper, a pink-eyed sugar mouse, the keys to my grandfather's house, a tiny pair of trainers with silver laces, and now my smile is straight, gonna hang up my braces. A marble, an angel scrap, a star, the very last sweetie out my advent calendar, a kiss under the mistletoe, a mitten still cracked with a crunch and a creak of snow, that glitter scarf I finally got sick of, a spoon with cake mix still to lick off, the dove of peace that our Darren made, some green thoughts in our tree's green shade. I'll hang up every evergreen memory of moments as melted and gone as that candle that was supposed to smell of cinnamon. Memories big as a house and as smalls, the baubles I used to call baubles. With pleasure, I'll treasure them. Then on proper Christmas Day, I'll show them all to you between the Queen's speech and Doctor Who. This is a slightly more serious seasonal poem. It's after John Donne's St. Lucy's Day poem. You know the poem that starts, "It is the year's midnight and the day's." And the thing about, it's much darker in Glasgow than it is here. It was quite a pleasure to be still walking about in the daylight at 4:30. I couldn't believe it. But it's always a big relief when it gets to the 21st and you know that it's tilting the other way. So after it's the year's midnight and the day's. At midday, on the year's midnight, into my mind came, I saw the new moon late yestreen with the old moon in her arms. Though no, there is no moon, of course. There's nothing very much of anything to speak of in the sky except a gai-grich greyness, rain-laden over Glasgow, and today there is the very least of even this for us to get, but the light comes back. The light always comes back, and this begins tomorrow with however many minutes more of sun and serotonin. Meanwhile, there will be the winter moon for us to love the longest, fat in the frosty sky among the sharpest stars. And lines of old songs we can't remember why we know or when first we heard them will aye come back, once in a blue moon to us, unbidden, bless us with their long-travelled light. This one is called the Ceiliach. The Ceiliach is the old woman of winter. I think I don't have any Scots Gaelic at all, but apparently everybody tells me that Scots Gaelic speakers and Irish Gaelic speakers can speak to each other, but they can't read each other's out loud because the orthography is completely different. But my friend and Matthew's great friend, Angus McNichol, the Gaelic poet, gave me the title for this. This is a real winter poem. I maybe better get my glasses out of there. Mary, could you cut in there? There's a wee set of glasses, you'll find them. They're in a, I think they're in the pink bag. No. So they're in a hard, a wee hard. glasses. Sorry about it. I'm deaf in one ear and going blind now. It's the kind of, and I can see you fine. It's the kind of glasses you get out the Euro shop. Anyway, here's the Keelia. Oh, much better, the glasses. I look like shit in the glasses, but I can see better. The Keelia. Bitter winter won't let up, never stop the old stranglehold. Blue moon, crystal gazers done her stint of wintering. High-handed, hard-bitten, her outrigger will outlast austere dog stars' death-watch stringencies. Brittle sun, spiking lights just grist to winter's mill. She's all set to put us through it. She'll crack down old Mama Iron Heel. She'll make us rue it. And this one is called View of Scotland Love Poem. It's another seasonal one. Very nostalgic. You know how we do Hogmanay big time in Glasgow? You probably do that here as well. You probably don't call it a Hogmanay. Hogmanay's the last day of the year. And this one, I had to do this today. I did a programme for Dublin from RTE, and they had asked for this one. And it made me think, yes, I want to read that. It's so evocative. It brought my mother back to me, big time. And other happy things, big time. View of Scotland, love poem. Down on her hands and knees at 10 at night in Hogmanay, my mother still giving it elbow grease, jiffy waxing the vinyl lay. This is too ordinary to be nostalgia. On the kitchen table, a newly opened tin of sockeye salmon. Though we do not expect anyone, the slab of black bun, petticoat tails fanned out on bone china. Last year it was very quiet. Mum's got her rollers in with wave set and her well-pressed good dress slack across the candlewick upstairs. Nearly 10:30 already and her not shifted. If we're to even hope to prosper, this midnight must find us how we would like to be. A new view of Scotland with a dangling calendar is propped under last year's, ready to take its place. Darling, it's 30 years since anybody was able to trick me December 31st into looking into a mirror to see a lassie with as many heeds as days in the year. And 2 already since, familiar strangers at a party, we did not know that we were the happiness we wished each other when the bells went, did we? All over the city, off licenses pull down their shutters. People make for where they want to be to bring the new year in. In high rises and tenements, sunburst clocks tick on dusty mantel shelves. Everyone puts on their best spread of plenty, for to even hope to prosper this midnight must find us how we would like to be. So there's a bottle of sickly liqueur among the booze on the alcove, golden crusts and steak pies like quilts in a double bed. And this is where we live. There is no time like the present for a kiss. And this one is a darker New Year poem, and then I'm going to go off the seasonal beat, I think. This one is just called Fetch on the 1st of January. A fetch is the image of yourself as your doppelganger. In every culture, it's very, very bad luck to see your own ghost. Shelley, the poet, famously saw his own ghost walking in the garden 2 days before he drowned. Apparently, in Yiddish culture, it can be good luck to see your own ghost, your own doppelganger, but for nobody else. And certainly a fetch isn't a very good idea to find one, even if it's yourself and the other sex. There we go. This is the first Scots poem I ever wrote, and I was surprised when it came out in Scots. So it's quite an old poem. Fetch on the 1st of January. Nae time after the bells, and the new year knew in with the usual crowd way, whiskey, cheers, and kisses. I'd about managed the windy shut, some clown had thrown wide, hoping to hear the hooters in the Clyde, when the door went. Well, well, who'd have thought I'd be stoning there to first boot myself? This some kind of a hunting out for Hogmanay? Hell nengie, you're a bad penny, Jimmy, Mr. Neardy near the wheel. Say chittern, ill clad for the cold, say drawn and pale, oh, with a black bun, burning a hole in your pocket, and the coal a live coal. Glengett, I should shout it, should shake a stick on my fist. Oh, but I should hunt you by Christ, the way you chased that big black tyke that dogged you once, mind, or the wife of Hope Street him. I'll no let you near me, don't make me laugh, got a much better half. Och, I to glower at each other was to keek in a gay distorted mirror, yet you've the neck to come back again with your bare face, Jake Fetch, the image of my ain. Ice round your mouth when you kiss me, the cold plumes of your breath. I'm lucking daggers, you're lucking like death. I'm damned if you'll get past my door, nae fear. Come away in, stranger. Happy New Year. A very old poem. I think maybe the first or second poem I ever wrote. It's just called The Choosing. We were first equal, Mary and I, with same coloured ribbons in mouse coloured hair, and with equal shyness, we curtsied to the Lady Counsellor for copies of Collins Children's Classics. First equal, equally proud. Best friends too, Mary and I. A common bond in being the cleverest equal in our small school, small class. I remember the competition for top desk or to read aloud the lesson at school service and my terrible fear of her superiority at sums. I remember the housing scheme where we both stayed. The same houses, different homes where the choices got made. Don't know exactly why they moved, but anyway they went. Something about a 3 apartment and a cheaper rent, but sometimes from the top deck of the high school bus, a glimpse among others on the corner, Mary's father, muffled, contrasting strangely with the elegant greyhounds by his side. He didn't believe in high school education, especially for girls, or in forking out for uniforms. 10 years later, on a Saturday, I am coming from the library, sitting near me on the bus, Mary, with a husband who is tall, curly-haired, has eyes for no one else but Mary, her arms around the full-shaped vase that is her body. Oh, you can see where the attraction lies in Mary's life. Not that I envy her, really. And I am coming from the library with my arms full of books, I think of those prizes that were ours for the taking and wonder when the choices got made we don't remember making. It's always the same. You always find that the poems that people like the best are your oldest poems. People, you don't necessarily get better at it as you get older, but you're stuck with keeping on doing it, aren't you? This one, another very old one. This one's called Poem for My Sister. I wrote it for my sister Janice's 12th birthday. She's 10 years younger than me. And it was her 57th birthday just a couple of days ago, so this poem wasn't born yesterday either. Poem for my sister. My little sister likes to try my shoes, to strut in them, admire her spindle-thin 12-year-old's legs in this season's styles. She says they fit her perfectly, but wobbles on their high heels. They're hard to balance. I like to watch my little sister playing hopscotch, admire the neat hops and skips of her, their quick peck, never missing their mark, not overstepping the line. She is competent at peaver. I try to warn my little sister about unsuitable shoes, point out my own distorted feet, the calluses, odd patches of hard skin. I should not like to see her in my shoes. I wish she could stay sure-footed, sensibly shod. I suppose in these last poems, they're personal poems, but I suppose there's a lot of social history in them. This particular poem's just called Social History. My mother never had sex with anyone else except my father. A week before her 3-day leave to get married, my mother was examined by the army doctor and pronounced Virgo intacta. 24 years old and Virgo intacta. An unusual thing in the ATS, an unusual thing in wartime, if you believe even half of what you read in the social history books. And the joke was, I wasn't even sure your dad was going to make it. Rumour was, they were going to cancel all leave prior to D-Day. So, it was touch and go till the last minute. The sex my mother could have had but didn't sounded fantastic. Clever Jewish boys from the East End of London whirled her round the dance floors, niftily slow foxtrotting her into corners, telling her the khaki matched her eyes. A soldier in a darkened carriage in a slow train wept on her shoulder when he told her that he'd lost his brother in North Africa. 2 naval ratings on Margate Pier slipped a string of cultured pearls in her pocket, said, "Miss, we just found these on the beach, and you are so pretty, we thought you ought to have them." She'd a very close and very tender friendship with a lovely, lovely, gentle NCO from the north of England who told her she was the image of his girlfriend. An Italian prisoner of war sketched her portrait, and her sister, who had her eye on him, was quite put out. She didn't care for Yanks, but that didn't stop them trying. A free Frenchman fell in love with her. A Polish Air Force man proposed. Any Scotsman she met down there had lovely educated accents and tended to be top brass. She mixed with folk from all over, which was the beauty of the services and the best of the party that was wartime, while the buzz bombs overhead didn't quite cut out. She was quite capable of downing a half of bitter and rolling out the barrel with all the other girls without ending up squiffy up against the wall afterwards with her knickers down, unlike some. When they all rode back to barracks late, swinging their lisle-soaking legs from the tailgate of a lorry, singing Apple Blossom Time, military policemen turned a blind eye in exchange for nothing more than a smile. Officers messed around with her in the blackout, but then my mother told them she was engaged to be married to my father, and they acted like the officers and gentlemen they were and backed off sharpish. So, my mother never had sex with anyone else except my father, which was a source of pride to her, being of her generation, as it would have been a source of shame to me, being of mine. This one is called The New Married Miner. I want to do a couple of poems that are male voice poems. This is the New Married Miner is speaking out loud. When in 1953 we moved to this housing scheme which had just been built, and it was in an old mining village, but all the pits were shut. Except I used to see this guy, I used to think of him as the last miner in Lanarkshire when I was a bit older. From when I was four onwards, I used to see him cycling home, very tired after a particular shift, all still covered in black smuts on this bike, really ancient and really tired. But when he came alive about 50 years later nearly and sang the song in my head to me, it wasn't the way he was when I saw him, tired and old, but as he must have been 50 years before that, when he was the new married miner. And it's him speaking. My shift is over, that was night time all day long. My love, it's lousing time, alone among these dog-tired colliers, mad routes for home. Bank up the fire with small coal till I come, and before tomorrow I'll not think again how sore and small the space I have to hunker in, or how huge and hard but true it pulls all day as at the pit head, black against the sky, the big wheel turns. Now my bike's coggling front wheel clicks and squeaks, my cold bones ache as hard for home I pedal, still blacked up like a darky minstrel. My long path home is starved of light, so I must do without. No moon tonight, so round and bright, so round and white, its davy lamp's gone out. Frost edges every blackened leaf, black snot flowers on my handkerchief. Heat my bass scalding, and bonny lass, I'll make the white lace of the lather black. Squeeze the hot soapy flannel at the nape of my neck and scribble long white chalk marks down my back. Put the dark fire to the poker till the hot flames burst in flower. Stretch out the towel and I'll stand up. Hold and fold me. Rub and scrub me as hard as you can till in your white warm arms, I'll end up a pink and naked man, my love. Your pink and naked man. And just one last chap before I end up with a wee bit of filth, actually. I was talking to Matthew last night that made me go home and write it down so that I could read it out, something I hadn't been planning to do. But this is about two of my favourite songwriters. The last three things I'm doing are all songs of one sort or another. This is about, I like all the, you know, the classic American songwriters, you know, from Cole Porter. He's the only one that wasn't Jewish, actually. They nearly all grew up speaking Yiddish at home, or their parents spoke Yiddish. and they were in love with the whole American language, and out of the slang and the fun, they could make poetry that would break your heart. And this is the daddies of them all from my point of view. This is called Ira and George. George and Ira. So here's the Gershwin brothers. And it's for Michael Mara, my late great wonderful friend, Michael Mara, the songwriter. And when I gave him it about 10 years ago, I said, well, Michael, you write the words and the music. You've got to be Ira to your own George, George to your own Ira. And so it's for him, really, in memory of him. Yes, he always said, the poem starts with a question. One of these songwriters, these classic songwriters, Sammy Cahn, says they were always asking songwriters, which comes first, the words or the music? And he said, first the phone call. My friend Michael Mara said that not the question they always ask you is, and do you come from a musical family? And he used to say, I. So Ira and George, for Michael Mara. First the phone call, as the man said, and he sure said a mouthful to that. Which comes first, words or music question? Who knows, except for every good one, there are 10 in the trash. Songs you slaved over that just won't sing, in which no lover ever will find some wisecrack twist itself to tell his unique heartbreak. So sore, so personal, so well he can't stop humming it. The simplest C chord melody might have legs once it's got the lyric, not June Smith's ham and eggs. Each catchphrase, colloquialism, each cliche, each snatch of overhead on a subway or street can say so much, so much when rhymed right, when phrased just so to fit its own tune that was born for it. A Manhattan night in 29 or 30. It's late. You're reading Herrick. Just back from a party, your brother calls out, hey, let's work. You watch him shuck his jacket, loose his black tie, and grab your book. Gather your rosebuds, he says, and slams it shut. He's right. Hard against the deadline, and at night, shoes off. Moon up, just daring you. Piano open, that's when you two can make it happen. The tune that smells like an onion, play it very slow. Then the one that sounds like the Staten Island Ferry till you hear the words. Brother, they're already there, under the siren and the train and the cab horn blare of his jazz of endless possibilities that will only fit its own fine-tuned lyric that is born for it. Gonna grab a wee whiskey now. To do the filthy endings, which is not me speaking at all. About maybe a good 15 years ago, this beautiful friend of mine, who's a very, very beautiful actress, because I'm a good friend of hers, I was asking her what her love life was like, and she said, absolutely non-existent. Perhaps it was the occupational hazard of working in the theatre and finding that all your friends were friends of Dorothy. I hadn't heard the expression at that time. At that time, I'd never heard the expression. But you know, I cottoned on right away. So when it came to her birthday, I wrote this in the voice of this dirty diva. It's just called Song for Dirty Diva, number one. Why are my friends all friends of Dorothy, friends of Dorothy? Now, I'm cool and I'm glib about gay lib, but finally it's got to me that all of my friends are friends of Dorothy. I got on well in gay bars. And the guys adore me. We even fancy the same film stars, and the crack is frank and free. They'll do my clothes, my hair, my decor, but they won't do me. Yeah, I can go some from here to kingdom come. Hey man, you must be Barmy. If you think you could exhaust me, yeah, you and... Who's Army? I could ball a rugby team and cream them all to orgasm. Take a caveman and his club to fill my yawning chasm. But all those guys who are really nice but not interested, all those Nancy's who don't fancy the tried and tested, you turn the other cheek and spurn what can't be bested. Oh, they huff and they puff and they get real vexed at my mainstream addiction to heterosex. And my thoroughly modern girlfriends all say to me, you ain't tried it, don't knock it. She'd suck it and see. I say, thanks a lot, but no thanks. That's not for me. I want a real man with a rock hard dose of the horn, who these days is as rare as a unicorn. I wish she'd pure skewer my penetralia and spatter my sheets with a map of Australia. But all my pals who are girls are strictly sapphic and do seem to deem it disgusting and pornographic. But my sex life's at a standstill, there is no through traffic, so at the risk of sounding politically incorrect, I need a crash course collision with something erect. But all of my friends are friends of Dorothy, and why, oh why, do they get that fixed at my mainstream addiction to heterosex? An imaginary character, the Dirty Diva, a completely imaginary character, but I met her in real life. Last year I was in Edmonton, Alberta, at a poetry conference it was really, poet laureates from all over Canada. And it was really good, you know, they gave us a very nice hotel and wonderful per diems, but it was room only. They did give us a per diem though. So I took to going along the block, wrap them up warm because it's brutal cold in Edmonton, Alberta in March, and going along for a breakfast that was both low cholesterol and low budget in a certain cafe organised by SAGE. That's the Seniors Association of Greater Edmonton. So the Sunshine Cafe of the Senior Association of Greater Edmonton. And one morning, after my eggs over easy, I was freshening up my lipstick at the mirror, and there she was, standing right next to me. It was the Dirty Diva herself. I knew her right away. You know, and it wasn't how she was dressed, nope. And it wasn't how well preserved she was, because she wasn't. She was 80 if she was a day and looked it. But you know, I would have known her anywhere. And she gave me a long look, and this is what it said. Just visiting, honey? Dream on. This, my darling, is the Ladies John of the Seniors Association of Greater Edmonton. And I'm here to tell you, honey, one fine day, you're going to find yourself permanently here in the Sunshine Cafe, fitting in perfectly amongst us old-timers with the arthritis and the arteriosclerosis and the Alzheimer's, which is not my problem, baby. Cruel thing is, I can remember way back when still had some oohs in my coos and he'd a little lead in his pencil. Oh, these days it's not the same, but give it a little elbow grease and I'm still game. Though, when you are more than 40 and 10, it's very fucking unlikely to be raining men. Soon you too will be grubbing around for the last of the last of the red hot lovers among the elasticated leisure suits and the comb overs. Back in 1956, darling, when my sex life was just begun, the fact you shouldn't was just part of the fun. Oh boy, the joy of being underage, oversexed, and in the back of someone's daddy's Cadillac. Soon the swinging 60s, and ooh baby, I swung got all the action that was going and plenty in my 20s when I was young. The Permissive Society, remember? That was a great club. I was happy to be a member. Fantastic. Fuck all forbidden. And everybody perked up at the prospect of being bedridden. Then in 69, it was a very good year, damn fine, for moon landings in 69. And in the 70s, did I slop a tad? Not a whit, not a bit of it. Are you mad? For there was always sex and drugs and having a laugh when a selfie was certainly not a photograph. Once there was powder in the powder room. You could get it on, no bother, and every which way, when two in a cubicle used to mean something other than what it means today. Remember before, when two pair of shoes under one locked door signaled sex, illicit and acrobatic. Now it's likely to be a carer and client, geriatric. Yeah, once there was pills, poppers, downers, uppers, proffered on offer, and no lacko, more than a whiff of more than a spliff of that wacky tobacco. Now my handbag still harbours drugs of every description, but these days, darling, they are all pre-scription. And she snapped her lipstick back in her purse. She gave me a look that said, could be worse. Yes, she said all this with a single look. Oh, it was eloquent. I could read it like a book. It said, forget the nips and tucks. There are no fucking answers. And off she hobbled to join her team of geriatric line dancers. Yes, off she went, leaving me alone before the mirror and the ladies John. It felt a little flat without her. She left a kind of absence in her wake. I sighed and I looked around me, and then, fuck's sake, a freebie that gave me the heebie-jeebies. Okay, a freebie potentially as handy as that indispensable friend of the caught short and randy that I've never seen the like of, never since they started dishing out them complimentary condoms in the 80s. Yeah, like after-dinner mints. Well, what can I say? But here today, in the female comfort station of the Sunshine Cafe, yes, here now, in the Ladies' John of the Seniors Association of Greater Edmonton, bald as brass, gratis and for free, openly, out there on the counter between the soap dispenser and the potpourri, right before my very eyes, lo and behold, very much to my surprise, free incontinence supplies! Thank you.